Thanks for tuning in to WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, co-host of Studio 2, and this is a Studio 2 Extra. For millions of Americans, bedtime sounds something like this. No, your radio did not malfunction. That is pink noise. It's the lower, gentler cousin of white noise. Think falling rain or the sound of the ocean. And it's widely marketed as a way to improve your sleep. But what if pink noise did the opposite?
I had done research on this topic for like 20 years of my scientific career, right? Always in the sense noise is bad. And I was so befuddled, like, why would you want to do that?
That's Penn Professor of Psychiatry Matthias Basner. When he realized people were using pink noise and other ambient sounds to fall asleep, he was skeptical. So he and his team gathered 25 healthy adults, put them in a sleep lab, and measured how their brains reacted to different sounds. The faint hum of jet planes, crying babies, and pink noise. As you'd expect, those intermittent noises, like the jet plane, reduce subjects' deep sleep. But that gentle pink noise? Well, it wasn't much better.
When we played back just the pink noise, we had a massive REM sleep reduction, but no deep sleep reduction.
So why is that important?
In the case of REM sleep, it's procedural memory. Like if you're learning to ride a bike or something, REM sleep is really important for consolidating that you're actually, you know, getting better at it. REM sleep is also really important for emotional regulation. So, for example, if you have a traumatic event and you're not getting enough REM sleep after that event, what's happening during REM sleep is that the arousal that is related with the trauma is actually disconnected from the memory. And if that's not happening, then the two stay connected. And this is why REM sleep has been implicated into post-traumatic stress disorder, for example.
So REM sleep helps us regulate our mood, and it helps us build brain power, helps us learn things.
Exactly.
I mean, those are two very important things.
Yes, absolutely. And it has also been implicated in neurodegenerative disease. For example, people who are a very early sign of Parkinson's is that there are changes to your REM sleep.
Wow.
So-called REM sleep behavior disorder, where you start acting out your dreams in bed, which is never a good idea, right? Also, for neurodevelopment, the interesting thing is that newborns will spend 50% of their sleep in REM sleep. And we as adults, approximately 20%. That kind of tells us how important this specific sleep stage is for those critical developmental phases across the early lifespan, right?
And for growth and development. It's
exactly,
so
exactly.
Okay, so this is a little bit counterintuitive for, maybe not for you, but for, I imagine, the layperson. You play pink noise and people seem to get less REM sleep. Any idea as to why?
Well, you know, we didn't measure this. We didn't like put electrodes into people's brains, right? We just had surface electrodes. But there's a little bit known about REM sleep. It's like there's structures in the midbrain that seem to be responsible for the initiation and maintenance of REM sleep. And we actually saw that in our study. It's both the initiation of REM sleep, that is, it took longer for people to find into REM sleep. It also took longer, you know, if they woke up out of a REM sleep period, it took longer for them to find back into REM sleep when the pink noise was present. But also the maintenance is just, you know, it was easier to wake them up out of REM sleep if the pink noise was there at the same time. So you could also, if there's these two distinct patterns, intermittent noise destroys like deep sleep, the pink noise destroys REM sleep. If you put them together, we got both. And actually, you know, the combination of intermittent noise with the pink noise made it even worse. Now, instead of 20-minute loss of REM sleep, we had like 30 minutes loss of REM sleep.
So that's interesting, right? Because I think one possible result is that there's a trade-off happening, which is that, let's just imagine someone lives in a noisy environment. They turn on pink noise. It helps them mask environmental noise, which might help them get better deep sleep. They give up some REM sleep. Maybe it's a worthy trade-off given that environment. What I'm hearing you say is that maybe it's not even a trade-off. It's just the two combining, making everything worse.
Right. I mean, that's definitely what we saw. It is true, though, that the pink noise helped somewhat mitigate the deep sleep loss. Mm. It wasn't like a huge effect, but we could see it.
There's some masking going on.
Right, exactly. And also the same is true with the sleep fragmentation that is waking up because of the environmental noise. We saw that to a lesser degree. However, if you woke up, it took you longer to find back into sleep, yeah. Right? So this is why I think it's like this compounding effect of combining the two that we then saw like a total mess, like less deep sleep, less REM sleep, more time awake.
So this is one study. And as you mentioned, there was some scientific evidence out there that pink noise might be helpful. So is your conclusion from this pink noise definitely bad, or we have to do further study to try to prove if this link is real and this test is repeatable?
Yeah, I would be a bad researcher if I said, you know, we had solved everything now with sure. a single study. First of all, it can never be a single study. Actually, when I first learned about that people are introducing a noise source into their bedroom, I was like, I had like done research on this topic for like 20 years of my scientific career, right? Always in the sense noise is bad. And I was so befuddled, like, why would you want to do that? And we talked about the masking. That, of course, makes sense. There's actually other theories that it might be like it might have sleep-promoting properties in and of itself, like a lullaby, which is like at least in white noise, it's like hard for me to believe. It could also be part of a sleep ritual, right, where you switch on the sound machine.
It's a cue potential.
It's a cue. Yeah, exactly. So I said,
now,
okay.
Now, could that still be the case?
It could be the case. I mean, the big limitation to our study is not only is it like kind of a limited sample size. Of course, it was great to go in the sleep lab. It's a hyper-controlled environment. We have control over everything, right? At some point, we want to go into the field, yeah. into people's homes. And the big limitation of our study is that we're not looking at long-term use and what it does to your sleep if you use it for longer periods of time. Yeah. It could be that you actually habituate somewhat to the pink
right.
noise or
get
broadband noise. Get used to it and that those negative effects on REM sleep, that they go away. Could also be that they're actually getting worse, right? We don't know
we don't know.
At this point.
And I also understand that you were testing people, this is not a scientific word, but they have kind of normal or somewhat healthy sleep habits, right? Like we're not looking at people that might have problems falling asleep, which is what you would use the cueing for.
Right. Yes. These were like hyper healthy people.
Yeah.
And also they did not use, you know, pink noise, white noise, whatever habitually at home. They were a novice to that
right.
kind of exposure. Right.
So there are these limitations, but it raises some questions, right? We know that millions of people are using noise when they sleep. They might have a fan on. They might be using an app. They might be using a sound machine. Your research raises what potential troubling questions about that mass use of noise to fall asleep?
Yeah. So, I mean, predominantly is the REM sleep inhibition,
yeah.
right?
That millions of people are hurting their REM sleep.
Right. And the thing is, and we were also like, I mean, we're especially worried, although we haven't measured sleep in children or newborns or toddlers, we're especially worried about that. We talked about how important, very likely, REM sleep is in that age group.
Because they spend about half their time in REM sleep
exactly.
at that age.
Yeah. And then you put a white noise machine next to the bed. And obviously, you have no insight into, you know, the sleep structure of the children because you have to have all these electrodes to measure that.
Yep.
Perhaps, you know, what parents do have insight into is that because sleep at that age is also very fragmented, and perhaps the pink noise and the white noise helps a little bit with children waking up less often. And then the parents think, oh, you know, my child sleeps much better when I have the noise machine
yep.
there. When in fact it's destroying REM sleep. Again, this is speculation. We don't know that. But I would say in terms of what it means for people, at least I would be, you know, careful at this point. And I would probably, you know, decide against putting a machine next to the crib of my newborn child, right? And I think the same is true for adults. I mean, I'm often asked, you know, so what are you suggesting then?
Right. I'm sure people say, Matthias, all the time, what should I do?
Exactly. So
because,
I say,
because the problem is people are sleeping in imperfect environments.
Right.
They're sleeping in cities. They're
right.
sleeping near highways.
Right.
And they genuinely don't know what
yeah.
to do.
And as you mentioned earlier, there may be this trade-off, right?
Right.
There is like it may be helping somewhat with deep sleep, with waking up less. And, you know, that's a benefit. And then there's the negative effect of the REM. So, you know, it is kind of a trade-off. And there's so many people who swear by it. You know, whenever I'm in a group of
yes.
people, I talk about my research. You know, there's somebody said, oh, yeah, I've been doing this for years. I love it. You know, I swear by it. So perhaps there must be something behind it. And, you know, we definitely need more research. But
that's the part that's hard for me to explain. Because obviously there are commercial entities that are promoting this idea of playing white noise, pink noise, whatever. There are apps that exist that talk about green noise and brown noise too.
Mm-hmm.
So there are people that are incentivized to do it. But if lots of people are doing it, it would suggest that they feel some sort of benefit.
Right.
And
right.
unless it's like a mass psychosis here, we've all kind of
right.
been tricked by marketing, you just, it's hard to imagine there's not something real behind it.
Exactly. Yeah. No, and this is why I'm saying, you know, this is one study and, you know, let's look into this further. There might be something behind it. But, I mean, the general problem is, and, you know, I have that in my research field where I look at the negative effects of aircraft noise or traffic noise, right? If you just ask people, we have so little insight into our sleep. Most of the night, we're actually unconscious. We're not aware
right.
of ourselves
right.
and our surroundings. So just asking people, I mean, and, you know, from clinical sleep medicine, obstructive sleep apnea, this is where your airways collapse, where you, you know, stop breathing, and then you wake up and your airways break open. These people have no insight into what's happening to them whatsoever.
It's a great mystery.
Exactly. Their sleep pressure is so high, they fall back to sleep right away. They never regain consciousness, right? This is why it's so important to actually do objective studies where we objectively measure sleep. And it may be that people are just, you know, delusional and that, you know, they think it works well for them and actually objectively there's nothing there. Or there may be something there, you know, once we go in the field and we make those measurements in people's home. But, I mean, for now I say if you want to continue using it, try to use it at the lowest noise level possible, because we are also like a little worried about effects on not only hearing in the long run, because the auditory system also needs to recover at some point. And the night is typically the best period for that. But no, you're putting the noise source in there and your auditory system has to translate that the whole night. So use it at the lowest possible level. And if your issue is really just falling asleep, you're using it to be able to fall asleep, put it on a timer. Because
yeah.
the first REM sleep episode takes typically at least an hour before you enter the first REM sleep episode. If you turn off the machine by then, you don't have the negative effects on REM sleep.
I like that solution a lot, because as someone who myself has struggled sometimes falling asleep, sometimes I think what people need psychologically, and this is a psychological process, right? Sometimes I think what people need is something that changes their environment that lets them know it's sleep time
mm-hmm.
and blocks the noises of the day. It might not matter whether it's pink noise, white noise, whatever, but it's that cueing system, it's that signal, and if it went off later, it wouldn't matter to them at all. They just
right.
have to get into that zone.
Yeah.
And they have to, you just like you need sometimes physical separation from a space in order to fall asleep, sometimes I think you also need like audio separation.
Yeah.
from whatever your norm is.
Yeah. And of course, I would be a really bad sleep researcher if I wouldn't mention that, you know, the noise is just one component of your sleep environment.
Right.
And sleep hygiene is like all about changes to your environment and to your behaviors that can promote a healthy sleep, right?
Right.
So, you know, the bedroom should be dark. It should be not only quiet, but also, you know, the temperature should be low, but not too low. You can start switching off lights in the evening just not to expose yourself to light levels that are too high. You know, don't spend too much, you know, screen time right before sleeping. No heavy meals before you go to bed. No excessive alcohol. You stop drinking caffeine at 3 p.m. So there's all these different things that you could do to help you sleep. And perhaps at that point, you don't need the
right.
the pink noise anymore. We totally forgot to talk about, we had one condition where we had people wear earplugs.
Yeah, so I actually want to get to this. This is not a all hope is lost type of study, right? It does seem like there are things you can do to improve your sleep from a sound perspective. What would that be?
Yeah, so the intermittent environmental noise can be blocked out pretty well by just wearing earplugs.
Good old-fashioned earplugs.
And, you know, we used the cheapest over-the-counter stuff that we could find. But we thought, you know, this is what, you know, the average Joe or Jane would be using. And, you know, basic foam earplugs. And we measured that they gave on average like a 25 dB reduction in the sound. And in those nights where people were wearing the earplugs and we played back the environmental noise, obviously you don't get any effects on REM sleep, so they don't have that problem. But these people recovered more than 70% of the deep sleep that they lost in the just environmental noise nights by wearing the earplugs. And we could actually see when we looked at the maximum sound pressure levels of the individual events that they started failing at the highest noise level at 65 decibels. Mm-hmm. But we just finished a huge study on the effects of aircraft noise on sleep around like 77 airports in the United States. We measured more than 40,000 aircraft noise events. It's a rarity that you measure 65 loud. Decibels yeah. in the bedroom.
You know, so earplugs are going to be good for most circumstances.
Exactly.
So if earplugs are an effective countermeasure, what is that telling us about what makes for good sleep?
Good sleep, like a sound environment, no pun intended.
Yeah.
That
is soundless.
Is soundless, that doesn't have these intermittent noise events that carry information, right?
So it's not necessarily about muting one sound with another sound. It's about the absence of sound. That's
exactly
what creates a good sound environment for sleep.
Exactly.
Okay. Before we wrap up, we understand that this is just one study. There's a lot more inquiry that needs to be done. This is maybe pointing us, though, in the direction of something pretty important. If indeed these pink noise devices and pink noise in general is disrupting sleep and millions of people are using it, what is the societal effect of that?
I don't know. But I agree that I think that it may be a major public health problem. Actually trying to find out, you know, how many people are doing this. You know, it's hard to find actually, you know, hard numbers around that. So I just, you know, Googled white noise. Or I put in white noise in YouTube, and the first five hits were collectively played back like, I don't know, 3.5 million times or so, yep. Right? Spotify plays back 300 million minutes of broadband sounds every day. The first five apps you can buy on white noise machines you can buy on Amazon have like hundreds of thousands of reviews. That just tells me this is not like an anomaly that there's yep. like a few people out there, but that like large parts of the population use it, not only for themselves but also for their children.
Yep.
So, you know, if this REM sleep effect holds true and it doesn't go away, it may actually be a major public health issue.
That was Matthias Basner, professor of psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, and this has been a Studio 2 Extra. Studio 2 is produced by Andreas Copes, Debbie Builder, and Hazel May Bryan. Al Banks engineered this podcast episode. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, and thanks for joining me.